the lives of your wives and sons and daughters, or I swear by the skies that my Bloodshrike will wipe out each of your gens one by one, Illustrian or not. They trip all over each other to swear. Of course they do, what with the screams of their now-dead paters echoing in their heads. With each oath proclaimed, the crowd cheers again. When it is done, Marcus turns again to the masses. I am your emperor, his voice booms out across the square. Foretold by the augurs, I will have order, I will have loyalty. Those who defy me will pay with their lives. The crowd cheers again, and, almost lost within the cacophony, the new pater of Gens Rufia speaks to one of the other paters beside him. What of Elias the Curious? He hisses. The emperor casts the finest men in the land to their deaths, while that bastard eludes him. The crowd does not hear the words, but Marcus does. The snake turns to the new pater slowly, and the man shrinks away, his eyes straying fearfully to the edge of the cliff. A fair point, Pater Rufius, Marcus says, to which I say, Elias Veturius will be publicly executed by Rathana. My Bloodshrike has men closing on him. Don't you, Shrike? Rathana? That's only a few weeks away. I hope, the Commandant says, that you will not bore His Majesty with more excuses. We would not wish to learn that your loyalties are as suspect as those of the traitors we just executed. How dare! You were given a mission, Marcus says. You have not succeeded. Cardium Rock is thirsty for the blood of traitors. If we do not slake that thirst with the blood of Elias Veturius, perhaps we will slake it with the blood of Gens Aquila. Traitors are traitors, after all. You can't kill me, I say. Cain said doing so would bring your own doom upon you. You are not the only member of Gens Aquila. My family. As the import of his words washes over me, Marcus's eyes light with that unholy joy he only seems to feel when he's got someone by the gut. You're engaged to Hannah. Appeal to his lust for power, I think frantically. Make him see that this will hurt him more than you, Helene. Gens Aquila is the only ally you have. He has Gens Veturia, the Commandant says. And I can think of... Oh! Marcus glances at the new Illustrian paters just yards away. About 10 other Gens that will adamantly back me. Thank you for that gift, by the way. As for your sister, he shrugs, I can find another high-born whore to marry. It's not as if there's a shortage. Your throne is not secure enough, his voice drops to a hiss. You dare to challenge me about my throne? My allies here, in front of the court? Never presume to think you know more than me, Bloodshrike, never. Nothing angers me more. My body turns to lead at the cunning calculation in his eyes. He steps toward me, his malice like a poison that saps my ability to move, much less think. Ah! He tilts my chin up and searches my face. Panic, fear, and desperation. I prefer you like this, Bloodshrike. He bites my lip, sudden and painful, his eyes open the whole time. I taste my own blood. Now, Shrike, he breathes into my mouth. Go fetch.
Chapter 29 Liar. That woman, the mask, the one they call the Commandant, she's killing them all. All the scholars, all the scholar prisoners. Skies, Keenan, I say. The rebel understands immediately, just like me. Tarin. The marshals are moving north, Keenan whispers. The scholars don't hear him, their attention fixed on Afia, who has yet to decide their fates. They likely haven't even reached Koff yet. The Commandant is methodical. If she's going south to north, she won't change the plan now. She still has to get through Antium before she gets to Koff.
Avia,
Zare calls from the edge of the camp, spyglass in hand.
Marshals incoming. Can't tell how many, but they're close.
Afia curses and the scholar man grabs her.
Please, just take the children.
His jaw is clenched, but his eyes fill.
Ayan is 2. Zenai is 6. The marshals won't spare them. Keep them safe. My sisters and I will run. We'll lead the soldiers off.
Afia. Izzy looks at the tribeswoman aghast. You cannot refuse them. The man turns to us.
Please, miss, he says to me. My name is Willard. I'm a rope maker. I'm nothing. I don't care about myself, but my boy, he's smart, so smart.
Gibran appears behind us and grabs Izzy's hand.
Quickly, he says. Get into the wagon. The marshals were tracking them, but they're killing every scholar they see. We need to get you hidden.
Afia, please. Izzy looks at the children, but Gibran pulls her toward his wagon, terror filling his eyes.
Liar, Keenan says. We should hide.
You have to take them in. I turn to Afia. All of them. I've been inside your smuggler's compartments. You have the space for it. I turn to Malad. Did the marshals see you and your family? Are they hunting you, specifically?
No, Malad says. We ran with 12 others. We got separated only hours ago.
Afia, you must have slavers' cuffs somewhere, I say. Why not do what we did in Nur?
Absolutely not.
Afia's voice is a hiss, and her dark eyes are daggers.
I'm already putting my tribe at risk with you lot, she says. Now shut up and get to your spot in the wagon. Liar, Keenan says. Come on. Soldara. Zare's voice is sharp. 12 men. 2 minutes out. There's a mask with them. Bleeding, burning skies.
Afia grabs my arm and shoves me bodily toward her wagon.
Get into that wagon, she snarls. Now.
Hide them, I dart forward, and Millard deposits his son into my arms. Or I'm not going anywhere. I'll stand here until the marshals come. They'll figure out who I am, and you'll die for harboring a fugitive.
Lies, Afia hisses. You wouldn't risk your precious brother's neck.
I step forward, my nose an inch from hers, and refuse to back down. I think of Mother, I think of Nan, I think of Darin. I think of all the scholars who have perished beneath the blades of the marshals.
Try me.
Afia holds my gaze for a moment before uttering something between a snarl and a shout.
If we die for this, she says, see if I don't hunt you through the hells until you pay. Vana, she calls to her cousin. Take the sisters and the girl. Use Riz's wagon and the rug wagon. She turns to Malad. You're with Lyra.
Keenan grabs my shoulder.
Are you sure?
We can't let them die, I say.
Go, before the marshals get here.
He darts away toward his hiding spot in Zare's wagon, and seconds later, Malad, Ayan, and I are inside Afia's wagon. I shove back the rug that hides a trapdoor in the floor. It is steel, reinforced, and heavy as an elephant. Malad grunts as he helps me lift it. It opens to reveal a shallow, wide space full of gas and fire powder. Afia's trick compartment. In the past few weeks, many of the marshals who have searched the caravan have found it and, satisfied that they've discovered her illegal stash, get lazy about hunting further. I pull on a hidden lever and hear a click. The compartment rolls back horizontally to reveal a space below the first. It's just big enough for 3 people. I drop in on one side, Malad on the other, and Ayan, wide-eyed, lies between us. Afia appears in the door of the wagon. Her face is still furious, and she is pointedly silent as she rolls the decoy compartment over us. The trapdoor thuds above that. The rug rustles as she straightens it. Then her footsteps recede. Through the slats in the compartment, horses snort and metal clinks. I smell pitch. The clipped tones of a marshal are clearly audible, but I can't make out what he's saying. A shadow passes over the compartment, and I force myself not to move, not to make a sound. I've done this exact thing 12 times already. Sometimes I've waited in here for 30 minutes, once for nearly 30 days. Steady, Lyra. Calm. Beside me, Ayan fidgets but keeps quiet. perhaps sensing the danger outside the compartment.
"A group of scholar rebels running this way," a flat voice speaks.
The mask.
"Have you seen them?"
"I've seen a slave or two," Afia says. "No rebels."
"We'll be searching your wagon anyway, tribeswoman. Where is your Zoldar?"
"I am Zoldara."
The mask pauses.
"Intriguing,"
he says in a way that makes me shudder. I can practically imagine Riz's hackles going up.
"Perhaps you and I can discuss it later, tribeswoman."
"Perhaps."
Afia's voice is a purr, so smooth that I would not have caught the thin thread of rage deep beneath the surface if I hadn't spent the last few weeks in close quarters with her.
"Start with the green one."
The mask's voice recedes. I turn my head, close one eye, and press the other to a space between the planks. I can just make out Jabran's mirror-encrusted wagon and the supply wagon beside it, where Keenan hides. I thought the rebel would want to hide with me, but the first time the marshals came, he took one look at Afia's compartment and shook his head.
"If we remain separate," he'd said, "then even if the marshals discover one of us, the others can still remain hidden."
Too soon, a horse snorts from nearby, and a soldier drops down from it. I catch a glimmer of a silver face and try to keep breathing. Beside me, Millard holds a hand to his son's chest. The stairs at the foot of Afia's wagon come down, and the heavy gait of the soldier's boots thunk above us. The footsteps stop. Doesn't mean anything. He might not see the seams in the floor. The trapdoor is designed so cleverly that even the decoy compartment is almost impossible to detect. The soldier paces back and forth. He leaves the wagon, but I cannot relax. For seconds later, he circles it.
"Zoldara," he calls to Afia. "Your wagon is built rather strangely."
He sounds almost amused.
"From the outside, the bottom of this wagon drops to a foot or so off the ground. But the inside is considerably higher."
"Tribes people like our wagon solid, my lord," Afia says. "Otherwise they break apart at the first pothole in the road."
"Orcs,"
the mask calls out to another soldier.
"Come here, Zoldara. You too."
Boots thud up Afia's stairs, followed by her lighter footsteps.
"Breathe, Lyra, breathe. We're going to be fine. This has happened before."
"Pull back the rug, Zoldara."
The rug shifts. A second later, I hear the telltale click of the trapdoor.
"Skies, no."
"You like your wagons solid, eh?" the mask says. "Not that solid, apparently."
"Perhaps we can discuss this," Afia says smoothly. "I'm happy to offer a small tribute if you'll simply overlook—"
"I'm not an Empire toll collector you can bribe with a brick of gas, tribeswoman."
The mask's voice is no longer amused.
"This substance is outlawed, and it will be confiscated and destroyed, as will the fire powder. Soldier, remove the contraband."
"All right. You found it. Now keep going."
The soldier lifts the gas out brick by brick. This, too, has happened before, though, until now, Afia has managed to dissuade the marshals from looking further with only a few bricks of gas. This mask doesn't move until everything in the compartment is gone.
"Well," Afia says when the orc soldier is finished. "Happy?"
"Not remotely," the mask says.
A second later, Afia swears. I hear a heavy thump, a gasp, and what sounds like the tribeswoman choking back a scream.
"Disappear, Lyra," I think to myself. "You're invisible, gone, small, smaller than a scratch, smaller than dust. No one can see you. No one knows you're here."
My body tingles, like too much blood rushing to my skin all at once. A moment later, the second portion of the compartment rolls back. Afia is slumped against the side of her cabin, one hand at her swiftly bruising neck. The mask stands inches away, and as I stare up into his face, I find that I am paralyzed with fear. I expect him to recognize me, but he has eyes only for Millard and Iron. The boy erupts into wails at the sight of the monster before him. He claws at his father, who desperately tries to shush him.
"Scholar trash," the mask says. "Can't even hide properly. Get up, rat, and shut your brat up."
Millard's eyes cut to where I lie, and then widen. Swiftly, he looks away, saying nothing. He ignores me. They all ignore me. As if I'm not there. As if they can't see me. Just like when you snuck up on the Commandant in Sarah. Like when you hid from the tribesmen at Raider's Roost. Like when Elias lost you in the crowd in Ner. You wish to disappear. And you do. Impossible. I think it must be some strange trick by the mask. But he makes his way out of the wagon, shoving Afia, Millard, and Iron before him. And I am left alone. I look down at myself and gasp. I can see my own body, but I can also see the grain of the wood through it. Tentatively, I reach out for the edges of the smuggler's compartment, expecting that my hand will go through, the way ghosts' hands do in the stories. But my body is as solid as ever. It's simply more translucent to my eye, and invisible to others. How? 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 Did the Ifrit in Sarah do this? These are questions I must answer. But later. For now, I grab Darin Sim and my dagger and pack and tiptoe from the wagon. I stick to the shadows, but I might as well walk in front of the torches, because no one sees me. Zer, Riz, Varna, and Jabran all kneel on the ground, their hands bound behind their backs.
"Search the wagons," the mask snarls. "If there are two scholar scum here, there are bound to be more."
A moment later, one of the soldiers approaches.
"Sir,"
he says,
"there's no one else." "Then you haven't looked hard enough."
The mask grabs one of the torches and lights Jabran's wagon on fire. "Is he?" "No," Jabran shouts, trying to break free from his bonds. "No!" A moment later, Izzy staggers out of the wagon, coughing at the smoke. The mask smiles.
"See," he says to his fellow soldiers, "like rats. All you need is to smoke them out. Burn the wagons. Where this lot is going, they won't need them."
"Oh, skies, I need to move. I count the marshals. There are a dozen of them. The mask, 6 legionnaires, and 5 orcs. Seconds after they light the fires, Millard's sisters emerge from their hiding spots, carrying little Zenna with them. The girl is unable to rip her terrified gaze from the mask.
"I found another!"
One of the orcs calls from the other side of the camp, and to my horror, he drags Keenan out. The mask looks Keenan over, grinning.
"Look at that hair," he says. "I've a few friends who fancy redheads, boy. Pity my orders are to kill all scholars. I'd have made a good bit of gold off you."
Keenan clenches his jaw, searching for me in the clearing. When he doesn't find me, he relaxes and puts up no fight as the marshals tie him up. They've found everyone. The wagons burn. In moments, they'll execute all of the scholars and likely drag Afia and her tribe to prison. I have no plan, but I move anyway, reaching for Darin Sim. Is it visible? It can't be. My clothes clearly aren't, and neither is my pack. I make my way to Keenan. "Don't move," I whisper into his ear. Keenan stops breathing for a second, but he doesn't so much as twitch beyond that. "I'm going to cut the bonds on your hands first," I say, "then your feet. I'm going to hand you a Sim." There's no indication that Keenan has heard. As I saw through the leather binding his hands, one of the legionnaires approaches the mask.
"The wagons are destroyed," he says. "We have 6 tribespeople, 5 scholar adults, and 2 scholar children." "Good," the mask says. "We'll..." "Ah!"
Blood fountains from the mask's neck as Keenan flies to his feet and whips Darin Sim up and across the marshal's throat. It should be a killing blow, but this is a mask after all, and he backs away quickly. He presses his hand to the wound, his features twisting into a snarl of rage. I run to Afia and cut through her ropes.
There is next. By the time I've gotten to Riz, Varna, and the scholars, all hell has broken loose in the clearing. Keenan grapples with the mask, who is attempting to wrestle him to the ground. Zaire dances around the blades of three legionnaires, shooting arrows so fast that I don't see him draw the bow. At the sound of a scream, I whirl and find Varna clutching her bloody arm as her father fights off two orcs with a cudgel.
Izzy, back!
Gibran shoves my friend behind him as he brandishes a sword against another legionnaire.
Kill them!
The mask bellows to his men.
Kill them all!
Malad shoves iron at one of his sisters and takes up a burning piece of wood that has popped off one of the wagons. He waves it at an approaching orc, who jumps back warily. On his other side, an orc soldier moves for the scholars. Sim out, but I leap forward. I bring my dagger into the small of the soldier's back and yank it upward, the way Keenan taught me. The man drops, twitching, to the dirt. One of Malad's sisters engages the other orcs, and when the soldier is distracted, Malad stabs at him with the firebrand, setting his clothes alight. The soldier screams and rolls wildly on the ground, trying to get the fire out.
You were gone,
Malad stutters, staring at me, but there's no time to explain. I kneel down, tearing the orcs' daggers from his body. I toss one to Malad and another to his sister.
Hide! I scream at them. In the woods! Take the children!
One of the sisters goes, but the other remains beside Malad, and together they attack a legionnaire bearing down on them. Across the camp, Keenan holds his own against the mask, helped, no doubt, by the blood pouring down the bigger man's neck. Afia's short Sim flashes wickedly in the firelight as she takes down an orc and turns immediately to do battle with a legionnaire. Zaire has taken out two of his attackers and battles the last ferociously. The last legionnaire circles Izzy and Gibran. My friend has a bow in her hand, and she notches it, aims at the legionnaire fighting Zaire, and puts an arrow straight into the marshal's throat.
A few yards away from her, Riz and Varna still battle the orcs.
Riz's brow is furrowed as he tries to fend off one of the soldiers. The man punches Riz in the belly. The silver-haired tribesman doubles over, and to my horror, a blade is sticking out of his back a moment later.
Father!
Varna screams.
Skies! Father!
Riz!
Gibran throws off one of the legionnaires with a blow and lurches toward his cousin.
Gibran!
I shriek. The legionnaire, who's been circling him, leaps forward. Gibran lifts his blade, but it shatters. Then, a flash of steel, a sickening crunch. The color drains from Gibran's face as Izzy staggers back, an impossible amount of blood geysering from her chest.
She's not dead. She can survive that. She's strong. I run for them, my mouth open in a rabid scream as the legionnaire who stabbed Izzy now lunges for Gibran.
The tribal boy's neck is open for the kill, and all I can think as I fly forward is that if he dies, Izzy will be heartbroken. Yet again. She deserves more than that.
Jib!
Afia's scream of terror is hair-raising, echoing in my ears as my dagger clangs against the legionnaire's Sim inches from Gibran's neck. I use a sudden adrenaline-fueled burst of strength to throw the soldier back. He is off balance for a moment before he grabs me by the throat and disarms me with a twist of his hand. I kick at him, trying to knee him in the groin, but he slams me to the ground. I see stars. Then a flash of red. Suddenly, a spray of hot blood hits my face and the legionnaire collapses atop me. Dead.
Lawyer!
Keenan shoves the man off me and pulls me to my feet. Behind him, the mask lies dead. As do the other marshals. Varna sobs beside her fallen father. Afia at her side. Iron clings to Malad, while Zena tries to shake her dead mother awake. Zaire limps to the scholars, blood leaking from a dozen slashes.
Lawyer!
Keenan's voice is choked, and I turn. No! No, Izzy! I want to close my eyes, to run from what I see. But my feet take me forward, and I drop beside Izzy, cradled in Gibran's arms. My friend's eye is open, and she seeks out mine.
I force myself to pull my gaze from the gaping wound in her chest. Damn the Empire. I will burn it down for this. I will destroy it. I scrabble at my pack. She'll need stitches is all. A witch hazel poultice. Tea. Some sort of tea. But even as I rifle through the bottles, I know that there is no vial, no extract strong enough to counter this. She has moments. If that. I take my friend's hand, small and cold. I try to say her name, but my voice is gone. Gibran sobs, begs her to stay. Keenan stands behind me, and I feel his hands drop to my shoulders and squeeze. Liloya! A bubble of blood forms at the corner of Izzy's mouth and bursts. Iz, I find my voice. Stay with me. Don't leave me. Don't you dare. Think of all the things you have to tell Cook. Liar, she whispers. I'm afraid. Izzy, I shake her gently, not wanting to hurt her. Izzy! Her warm brown eye meets mine, and for a moment, I think she's going to be fine. There is so much life there. So much. Izzy. For a single heartbeat, she looks at me. Into me. Like she can see down into my soul. And then, she's gone.
Chapter 30. Elias. The kennels outside cough, reek of dog droppings and rancid fur. Even the scarf pulled across my face can't mask it. I gag at the stench. From where I sidle in the snow along the building's southern wall, the cacophony of the dogs is deafening. But when I peer into the entrance, the fiver on guard duty is fast asleep beside the kennel fire, as he has been the past 3 mornings. I inch the kennel door open and stick to the walls, still swathed in pre-dawn shadows. 3 days of planning, of waiting and watching, have led to this. If all goes well, I'll have broken Darin out of cough by this time tomorrow. Kennels first. The kennel master visits his domain once a day, at second bell. 3 fivers trade shifts around the clock, but there is only one on duty at a time. Every few hours, one of a series of orc soldiers emerges from the prison to muck out the stalls, feed and exercise the animals, and tend to repairs on the sleds and reins. At the shadowy end of the structure, I stop beside a pen, where 3 dogs bark at me as if I'm the Nightbringer himself. The legs of my fatigues and the back of my cloak shred easily. They are already worn through. I hold my breath and use a stick to soil my other pant leg with dung. I pull up the hood on my cloak. Oi! I bellow, hoping the shadows are deep enough to hide my clothing, which is clearly not a cough uniform. The fiver jerks awake and spins, his eyes wild. He spots me and gibbers a defense, dropping his eyes out of respect and fear. I cut him off. You're asleep on the bleeding job! I roar at him. Orcses, particularly plebeians, are spat on by everyone else at cough. Most tend to be extra nasty to the fivers and the prisoners. The only people at cough they can boss. I should report you to the kennel master. Sir, please. Stop yipping. Had enough of that from the dogs. One of the bitches attacked when I tried to take her out. Ripped my clothes straight through. Bring me another uniform. A cloak and boots too. Mine are covered with dog scat. I'm twice your size, so make sure it fits. Don't bleeding tell the kennel master. Last thing I need is that bastard cutting my rations. Yes, sir. Right away, sir. He darts out of the kennel, so frightened that I'll turn him in for sleeping on duty, that he doesn't look twice at me. While he's gone, I feed the dogs and muck out the pens. An orc showing up earlier than usual is strange, but not noteworthy, considering the kennel master's lack of organization. An orc showing up and then not performing his assigned task would set off alarm bells. When the fiver returns, I'm stripped to my breeches, and I order him to leave the uniform and wait outside. I toss my old clothes and shoes in the fire, shout at the poor boy again for good measure, and turn north to cough. Half of the prison is rooted inside the darkness of the mountain behind it. The other half erupts from the rock like a diseased growth. A wide road snakes down from the enormous front gate, running like a rivulet of black blood along the river dusk. The prison walls, twice as high as black cliffs, are almost ornate, with friezes, columns and gargoyles hewn from the pale grey rock. Orcs archers patrol the crenellated ramparts, and legionnaires man four lookout towers, making the prison difficult to break into, and impossible to break out of. Unless one is a mask who has spent weeks planning it. Above, the cold sky is lit green and purple by undulating ribbons of light. The Northern Dancers, they're called, the spirits of the dead battling for eternity in the skies, at least according to martial law. I wonder what Shaver would say about it. Maybe you can ask her in a fortnight when you're dead. I feel for the store of Telus in my pocket, a 2-week supply, just enough to get me to Rathana. Other than the Telus, the lockpick, and the throwing knives across my chest, my belongings, including my Telemon Sims, are hidden in the cave where I plan to stow Darin. The place was smaller than I remembered, half collapsed and covered in debris from mudslides. But no predators had claimed it, and it is large enough to camp in. Darin and I should be able to lie low there until Lyra arrives. I narrow my focus to Koff's yawning portcullis. Supply wagons snake up the road leading to the prison, bringing winter foodstuffs before the passes are snowed in. But with the sun not yet up, and a guard change imminent, the deliveries are chaotic, and the guard sergeant isn't paying attention to who is coming and going from the kennels. I approach the caravan from the main road, and sidle in among the other gate guards searching the wagons for contraband. As I peer into a crate of gourds, a truncheon slams into my arm.
"Already checked this one, you dolt,"
a voice says behind me, and I turn to face a surly, bearded legionnaire.
"Apologies, sir,"
I bark out, quickly bolting to the next wagon. "Don't follow. Don't ask my name. Don't ask my squad number."
"What's your name, soldier? I haven't seen you before." Boom, 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 boom.
For once, I'm bleeding thrilled to hear the drums, which signal the guard change. The legionnaire turns, distracted for a moment, and I dart into the crowd of orcs heading into the prison. When I look back, the legionnaire has turned to the next wagon.
"Too close, Elias."
I keep slightly behind the orc squad, my hood up and scarf wrapped close. If the men notice an extra soldier among them, I'm dead. I fight to ease the tension in my body, to keep my gait steady and exhausted.
"You're one of them, Elias. Bone tired after the graveyard shift, ready for grog and bed."
I pass through the snow-dusted prison yard, twice the size of Blackcliff's training field. Torches, blue fire and pitch, illuminate every inch of the space. The prison's innards, I know, are similarly lit. The warden employs 2 dozen orcs whose sole job is to make sure those torches never go out. No prisoner of Koff can ever claim the shadows as allies. Though I risk being called out by the men I'm with, I work my way to the middle of the group as we approach the main prison entrance and the 2 masks flanking it. The masks cast their eyes over the men entering, and my fingers twitch toward my weapons. I force myself to listen to the low conversation of the orcs.
double shifts because half the pit platoon got food poisoning. New prisoners arrived yesterday. A dozen of them. Don't see why we bothered processing them. Commandant's on her way, Captain said. New Emperor has ordered her to kill every last scholar here.
I stiffen at the words, trying to control the anger flooding every pore. I knew the Commandant was scouring the countryside for scholars to kill. I didn't realize she was attempting to exterminate them entirely. There are more than 1,000 scholars in this prison, and they will all die under her command. 10 hells. I wish I could free them, storm the pits, kill the guards, incite a revolt. Wishful thinking. Right now, the best thing I can do for the scholars is get Darin out of here. His knowledge will at least give his people a chance to fight back. That is, if the warden hasn't destroyed his body or mind. Darin is young, strong, and obviously intelligent. The exact type of prisoner the warden likes to experiment on. I pass into the prison, the masks none the wiser, and head with the other guards down the main corridor. The prison is arranged in an enormous pinwheel, with 6 long halls as spokes. Marshals, tribesmen, mariners, and those from beyond the Empire's borders occupy 2 blocks of the prison on the east side. Scholars occupy 2 blocks on the west. The last 2 blocks house the barracks, mess hall, kitchens, and storage. At the very center of the pinwheel sit 2 sets of stairs. One leads up to the warden's office and Mask's quarters. Another leads down, down, down to the interrogation cells. I shudder, pushing the thought of that foul little hell from my mind. The orcs around me drop their hoods and scarves, so I fall back. The scruffy beard I've grown in the past few weeks is an adequate disguise, as long as no one looks too closely. But these men will know I wasn't on duty with them at the gate. Move, Elias. Find Darin. Lyra's brother is a high-value prisoner. The warden will have heard the rumors that Spiro Telemann spread about the boy's smithing prowess. He'll want to keep him separate from the rest of Koff's population. Darin won't be in the scholar pits or the other major prison blocks. Prisoners stay in the interrogation cells for no more than a day. Any longer, and they come out in a coffin. Which leaves solitary confinement. I move quickly past the other guards on their way to their varied postings. As I pass the entrance to the scholar pits, a blast of stinking heat hits me. Most of Koff is so frigid you can see your breath cloud the air. But to keep the pits hellishly hot, the warden uses enormous furnaces. Clothing disintegrates in weeks in the pits. Sores fester. Wounds rot. Weaker prisoners die days after getting here. When I was a fiver stationed here, I asked a mask why the warden didn't let the cold kill off the prisoners.
Because heat makes them suffer more, he said.
I hear proof of that suffering in the wails that echo through the prison like a demon's chorus. I try to block them out, but they punch through my mind anyway.
Go, damn it.
As I approach Koff's main rotunda, an uptick in activity catches my attention. Soldiers moving swiftly away from the center staircase. A lean, black-clad figure descends the steps, his masked face gleaming.
Damn it!
The warden. The one man in this prison who will know me on sight. He prides himself on remembering the details of everything and everyone. I curse quietly. It's 6:15 bell, and he always enters the interrogation cells at this time. I should have remembered. The old man is yards from me, speaking with a mask at his side. A case dangles from his long, thin fingers. Tools for his experiments. I force down the disgust rising in my throat and keep walking. I'm passing the stairs now, just yards from him. Behind me, a scream pierces the air. Two legionnaires march past, escorting a prisoner from the pits. The scholar wears a filthy loincloth, and his emaciated body is covered with sores. When he catches sight of the iron door that leads to the interrogation block, his cries grow frantic, and I think he's going to break an arm attempting to escape. I feel like a fiver again, listening to the misery of the prisoners, unable to do anything but seethe with useless hate. One of the legionnaires, sick of the man's howls, lifts a fist to knock him unconscious.
No!
The warden calls from the stairs in his eerie, reedy voice.
The scream is the purest song of the soul,
he quotes.
The barbarous keen yokes us to the low beasts, to the unutterable violence of the earth.
The warden pauses.
From Tiberius Antonius, philosopher to Tyus the Tenth. Let the prisoner sing,
he clarifies.
So his brethren hear.
The legionnaires drag the man through the iron door. The warden moves to follow, but then slows. I am nearly across the rotunda now, close to the hallway that leads to solitary confinement. The warden turns, scanning the corridors on five sides, before his eyes land on the one I'm about to enter. My heart nearly drops out of my chest. Keep walking. Try to look grumpy. He hasn't seen you for 6 years. You have a beard. He won't recognize you. Waiting for the old man's gaze to pass is like waiting for the executioner's axe to fall. But after long seconds, he finally turns away. The door to the interrogation cells clangs shut behind him, and I breathe again. The corridor I enter is emptier than the rotunda, and the stone stairway leading to solitary confinement is emptier still. A lone legionnaire stands guard at the block's entry door, one of three that lead to the prison cells. I salute, and the man grunts a response, not bothering to look up from the knife he's sharpening. Sir, I say, I'm here to see about a prisoner transfer. He lifts his head just in time for his eyes to widen fractionally at the fist flying into his temple. I stop his fall, relieve him of his keys and uniform jacket, and ease him to the ground. Minutes later, he is gagged, bound, and stuffed into a supply closet nearby. Hopefully, no one opens it. The day's transfer sheet is nailed to the wall beside the door, and I scan it quickly. Then I unlock the first door, the second, and the last, to find myself in a long, dank hallway lit by a single blue fire torch. The bored legionnaire manning the entry station glances up from his desk in surprise.
"Where's Corporal Libran?"
he asks. "Ate something that turned his stomach," I say. "I'm new. Came in on the frigate yesterday." Surreptitiously, I drop my eyes to his tags. Corporal Coltar. A plebeian, then. I offer a hand. "Corporal Scribor," I say. Upon hearing a plebeian name, Coltar relaxes.
"You should get back to your post," he says.
At my hesitation, he grins knowingly.
"I don't know about your old posting, but the warden here doesn't allow the men to touch the solitary prisoners. If you want jealous, you'll have to wait until you're assigned to the pits."
I bite back my disgust. "Warden told me to bring him a prisoner at 7th bell," I say. "But he's not on the transfer sheet. You know anything about it? Scholar lad. Young. Blonde hair. Blue eyes." I force myself not to say more. "One step at a time, Elias." Coulthard grabs his own transfer sheet.
"Nothing on here."
I let a touch of irritation enter my voice. "You sure?" Warden was insistent. "The boy's high value. Whole countryside is talking about him. They say he can make Serik steel."
Ah, him.
I still my features into a semblance of boredom. Bleeding hells. Kultar knows who Darin is, which means the boy is in solitary.
Why in the bleeding hells would the warden ask for him?
Kultar scratches his head.
Boy's dead. Has been for weeks.
My euphoria vanishes. Dead? Kultar looks at me askance, and I flatten my voice.
How'd he die? Went down to the interrogation cells and never came out. Served him right. Jumped up little rat. Refused to give his number during lineup. Always had to announce his filthy scholar name. Darin. Like he was proud of it.
I sag against Kultar's desk. His words sink in slowly. Darin can't be dead. He can't be. What will I say to Lyra?
You should have gotten here faster, Elias. You should have found a way.
The enormity of my failure is staggering, and though Blackcliff trained me to show no emotion, I forget it all in this moment.
Bleeding scholars moaned about it for weeks when they heard.
Kultar, utterly oblivious, chuckles to himself.
Their great saviour, gone. Jumped up, you called him.
I yank the legionnaire toward me by his collar.
Much like you, down here doing a job any idiot fiver could. Yammering about things you don't bleeding understand.
I headbutt him hard and shove, my rage and frustration exploding through my body and pushing my good sense aside. He flies back and hits the wall with a sick thud, his eyes rolling up into his head. He slithers to the floor, and I give him a last kick. He won't be waking up any time soon, if ever.
Get out of here, Elias. Get to Lyra. Tell her what's happened.
Still enraged from the news that Darin is dead, I drag Kultar to one of the empty cells, toss him inside, and turn the lock. But when I head to the door leading out of the block, the latch rattles.
Doorknob! Key in lock! Lock turning! Hide!
My mind screams the words at me.
Hide!
But there's no place to do so other than behind Kultar's desk. I dive down, pulling my body into a ball, heart thumping and knives at the ready. I hope it's a scholar slave coming in to bring the meals, or a fiver delivering an order, someone I can silence. Sweat beads on my forehead as the door opens, and I hear a light step on the stones.
Elias.
I go utterly still at the warden's thin voice.
No. Damn it. No.
Come out of there. I've been waiting for you.
Chapter 31. Helene. My family or Elias. My family or Elias. Avitas follows me as I leave Cardium Rock. My body feels numb with disbelief. I do not notice him dogging my heels until I'm halfway to Antium's northern gate. Leave me. I wave a hand at him. I don't need you.
I'm tasked with...
I whirl on him, a knife to his throat. He puts his hands up slowly, but without the wariness he'd have if he thought I was actually going to kill him. Something about it makes me even angrier.
I don't care. I need to be alone, so stay away from me, or your body will soon find itself looking for a new head.
With respect, Shrike, please tell me where you're going, and when you'll return, if something happens.
I'm already walking away from him.
Then your mistress will be pleased, I call back. Leave me be, Harper. That's an order.
Minutes later, I'm departing Antium. Not enough men manning the north gate, I find myself thinking, a desperate attempt to keep my mind off what Marcus has just told me. I should chat with the captain of the city guard about that. When I look up, I realize where it is I am headed. My body knew before my mind. Antium is built in the shadow of Mount Fidens, where the augurs lurk in their rocky lair. The path to their caves is well trod. Pilgrims set out before dawn every day, climbing high into the Nevenees to pay homage to the red-eyed seers. I used to think I understood why. I used to think Elias's frustration with the augurs smacked of cynicism, blasphemy even.
"Conniving tricksters," he'd said, "cave-dwelling charlatans."
Perhaps all this time he was right. I passed the few pilgrims making their way up the mountain, and I am fueled by rage and something I don't care to identify. Something I last felt when I swore fealty to Marcus. Helene, you are such a fool. I realize now that some part of me hoped Elias would escape, no matter what happened to the Empire as a result. Such weakness! I loathe that part of myself. Now I can have no such hope. My family are blood, kin, gens. And yet I didn't spend 11 months of every year with them. I didn't make my first kill with them at my side, or walk Blackcliff's haunted, deadly halls with them. The trail winds up 2,000 feet before flattening out into a pebble-strewn bowl. Pilgrims mill in a crowd at the far end beside an unobtrusive cave. Many approach the cave, but some unknown force stops them a few yards from its entrance. "Just try and stop me," I scream in my mind at the augurs. "See what happens." My anger propels me past the knot of pilgrims and straight to the entrance of the cave. An augur waits there in the darkness, her hands folded before her.
"Lartrike."
Her red eyes glimmer from beneath the hood, and I strain to hear her.
"Come."
I follow her into a corridor lit with blue fire lamps. Their glow tinges the glittering stalactites above us, a startling cobalt. We emerge from the long corridor into a high, perfectly square cave. A large pool of still water sits at its very center, lit by an opening in the cave rock directly above. A solitary form stands beside the pool, gazing into its depths. My escort slows.
"He awaits you."
She nods to the figure. "Cain,
temper your anger. Bloodshrike, we feel your rage in our blood, the way you feel the bite of steel on your skin."
I stride toward Cain, my hand tight on my sim. "I will crush you with my anger. I will flatten you." I stop short before him, a vile curse upon my lips. Then I meet his sober gaze and shudder. Strength fails me. "Tell me he'll be all right." I know I sound like a child, but I can't stop myself. "Like before. Tell me that if I hold to my oath of fealty, he won't die."
"I cannot do that, Bloodshrike."
"You told me that if I held true to my heart, the Empire would be well served. You told me to have faith. How do you expect me to have faith if he's going to die? I have to kill him, or my family is lost. I have to choose. Can you comprehend?"
"Bloodshrike," Cain says, "how is a mask made?"
"A question for a question. Father did this when we argued philosophy. It always irritated me." "A mask is made through training and discipline."
"No. How is a mask made?"
Cain circles me, his hands in his robes, watching from beneath his heavy black cowl. "Through rigorous instruction at Blackcliff." Cain shakes his head and takes a step toward me. The rocks beneath me quaver.
"No, Shrike. How is a mask made?"
My anger sparks, and I yank it back like I would the reins of an impatient horse. "I don't understand what you want," I say. "We're made through pain, suffering, through torment, blood and tears." Cain sighs.
"It's a trick question, Aquila. A mask is not made. She is remade. First,
she is destroyed. Stripped down to the trembling child that lives at her core. It doesn't matter how strong she thinks she is. Blackcliff diminishes, humiliates, and humbles her. But if she survives, she is reborn. She rises from the shadow world of failure and despair so that she might become as fearful as that which destroyed her, so that she might know darkness and use it as her sim and shield in her mission to serve the Empire. Cain lifts a hand to my face like a father caressing a newborn, his papery fingers cold against my skin. "You are a mask." "Yes," he whispers, "but you are not finished. You are my masterpiece, Helene Aquila, but I have just begun. If you survive, you shall be a force to be reckoned with in this world. But first, you will be unmade. First, you will be broken."
"I'll have to kill him then? What else could this mean? The best way to break me is Elias. He has always been the best way to break me. The trials, the vow I made to you, it was all for nothing."
"There is more to this life than love, Helene Aquila. There is duty, empire, family, gens, the men you lead, the promises you make. Your father knows this. So will you, before the end."
His eyes are unfathomably sad as he lifts my chin.
"Most people," Cain says, "are nothing but glimmers in the great darkness of time. But you, Helene Aquila, are no swift-burning spark. You are a torch against the night. If you dare to let yourself burn."
"Just tell me."
"You seek assurances," the augur says. "I can offer you none. Breaking your fealty will have its cost, as will keeping it. Only you can weigh those costs."
"What will happen?" I don't know why I ask. It's futile. "You see the future, Cain. Tell me. Better that I know."
"You think knowing will make it easier, Bloodshrike," he says. "But knowing makes it worse."
A millennia-old sadness weighs upon him, so consuming that I have to look away. His whisper is faint, and his body fades.
"Knowing is a curse."
I watch him until he's gone. My heart is a vast chasm, empty of everything but Cain's warning and a staggering fear.
"But first, you will be unmade."
Killing Elias will destroy me. I sense that truth in my bones. Killing Elias is my unmaking.
Chapter 32. Liar. Afia gave me no time to say goodbye, to mourn. I slipped Izzy's eye patch off, threw a cloak over her face, and fled. At least I escaped with my pack and Darin's sim. Everyone else has only their clothes and the goods stowed in the horses' saddlebags. The horses themselves are long gone, stripped of any sigils and sent galloping west the moment we reach the river Tyus. Afia's only words of farewell to the beasts were wrathful mutters about their expense. The boat she stole off a fisherman's pier will soon be gone too, through the sagging door of a mould-fuzzed barn in which we have taken refuge. I can see Keenan standing at the riverside, sinking the boat. Thunder rumbles. A drop of sleet shoots through the hole in the barn's roof and lands on my nose. Hours remain until dawn. I look to Athia, who holds a dim lamp.